from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1988 when a man decided to go back to school. Greg Jones was 29 years old, and he had been a chef. He had managed high-wattage restaurants. He owned two golf retail stores, but his father suggested he go back to school, at least get a GED. That conversation quite literally changed the course of an unlikely field of study, the study of how climate change impacts the wine industry. Now, in going back to school, Greg initially wanted to study hydrology, according to a profile in the Oregon Wine Press. But he shifted to studying climatology and how climate impacts agriculture. And then his father asked Greg a question. Can you grow Spanish grapes like Tempranillo on the West Coast? Well, there should be a pretty simple answer for this, but there wasn't. Greg realized there was almost no study of where to grow which grapes and how the shifting climate was going to impact the wine industry and what you can and can't grow. So he built his own field of study, essentially. He's become one of the leading voices in the world in the wine industry. And today we need voices like Greg's more than ever. That's because climate change is causing significant change in the wine industry. And it's not as simple as saying, well, it's bad for California, but good for places like the Finger Lakes. Yes, there might be so-called winners and losers to some degree, but it is much more complex than that. This coming Monday night, Hunt Country Vineyards in the Finger Lakes is hosting a tasting and an event focused on both green wines, what they are and what they aren't, and the impact of climate change on the industry and what they're trying to do to mitigate it. But first, we want to explore those themes right here on Connections. And my guests include Suzanne Hunt, who's the owner of Hunt Green LLC and a member of the Hunt family, which owns Hunt Country Vineyards on Keuka Lake and is hosting that event on Monday. Welcome back to the program, Suzanne.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with me in studio is Alan Laxo, and Dr. Laxo is a professor emeritus in the School of Integrative Plant Sciences at Cornell University, and he taught me all I know, which is not much, but still some, about the impact of climate change on the Finger Lakes industry probably 6-7 years ago, so it's good to revisit this with you, Alan. Thanks for being
nice
here.
Nice to be here again. Thank
and
you.
On the line with us is Dr. Greg Jones, a research climatologist focusing on the impact of climate on the wine industry at Southern Oregon University. And Greg, I'm so glad to talk to you, and thank you for taking the time for our program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let me start with you, Suzanne, just because you're the reason we had this conversation. We found out on Monday you have this event. It's technically a Women for Wine Sense event, but it's not just for women on Monday night, right?
Right. Anyone can come, but it is a women's group that hosts these monthly events. And they asked me to speak about green wine, and I thought we couldn't talk about that without talking about climate change.
Okay, so that's Monday night at Hunt Country Vineyards.
Yep.
And it's $50, $40 if you're a member, $50 if you're not a member. They're going to have a farm-to-table menu on hand. They're going to taste more than half a dozen wines, green wines from around the world. And you're going to give a presentation?
Yes. Exactly.
So on this, and are you going to focus on green wines? Are you going to focus on climate? You're going to split it up? What are you going to do?
Well, they asked me to tell a little bit of my story, and then they asked me to talk about the difference between sustainable wines, biodynamic wines, organic wines, and then I added on that aspect of talking about climate change and how it affects the industry. And, you know, as we talk about what the wineries are doing to mitigate and adapt and be able to grow beautiful wines in the changing climate, it all interrelates.
Mitigate and adapt are two very different things, and as we go throughout the hour, I think we should talk about what your family is doing, what you see the industry doing. But let me start with Greg, because his time is more limited on our program here. And Greg, I just kind of want to go back a little bit. You know, we hear conversation about the impact of climate change on the wine industry all the time now, but I want to know, when did you first really notice that sort of the broader public, or at least the wine industry itself, was much more in tune with the fact that it's here, it's happening, and we must be aware of it?
Well, you know, I think the wine industry, number one, is a very proactive agribusiness that is really largely sustainable in its own right. But the producers worldwide know that climate is a very important aspect of what they're doing. And, you know, I think back when I first started looking at this topic, I saw that there was some ways in which climate scientists could help the viticulture wine production arena. By looking at climate in some different and more maybe holistic ways. And the other piece of it is that I've had some chances through my family to also know what it takes to grow grapes and make wine. And so having kind of my hand in both of those arenas has really kind of helped me understand the system a lot better.
Yeah, tell our listeners a little bit more about that. You know, your dad inquired about growing Spanish grapes on the West Coast, and now it's a family business. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, when I went back to school, I really thought that being a water resource manager, a hydrologist, was going to be the most interesting thing that I could do in my career. And so I started down that path, and I got flipped to the climate side of things because of a couple of very good faculty members at the University of Virginia who really kind of jazzed me on the idea that, you know, climate is just a different type of fluid. You know, the atmosphere is a fluid and acts a lot like water, but it's very dynamic and it influences a lot of what we do. And so when I started studying the topic, I was just getting into this whole fray of trying to understand the complexities of a climate scientist. And my father asked me some questions, and I looked deep into the viticulture world and saw that, yes, viticulturists and wine producers knew a lot about climate. They knew that it was a cornerstone of really their success to have the right wine style or variety growing in a given area. But when I looked at it deeper, I found that there just wasn't much climate science being done in that arena. And so I started helping my dad answer some of his questions. I found that there were many questions that couldn't be answered because there wasn't enough data. And so by helping him, it kind of catapulted me down the line of really looking at this as being my career. And, you know, now 25 years later, it's pretty amazing to look back at it.
And your dad and your family's winery is what?
We have a winery in the Umpqua Valley of Oregon, and it's called Abacela. It's an old Spanish word that means to plant a grapevine on a hillside. And we planted our first grapes in 95. The family's vineyard is known for planting the first Tempranillo in the Northwest and largely quite a few other varieties as well. And so we do a lot of Iberian, Portuguese, Spanish type of varieties. And we're about ready to go into our 23rd vintage.
Well, I want to ask you a question, but I want to give it a caveat before I ask it. I recall going to Santa Barbara County, Santa Barbara, California, and took a trip in a vehicle, a sort of a death-defying trip up one of those, you know, sandy vineyard hills with a winemaker named Sashi Mormon, who I think is one of the really great winemakers in this country. And he was telling me, he said, please do not overgeneralize about regions. You know, people say, well, is this region good for this or that? We were in the Santa Rita Hills, and he said the western part of the Santa Rita Hills near the coast is a lot different than where the road divides, and the inland part is actually a lot warmer. And so they grow a lot of Pinot Noir there, and it's very different on the coast compared to even inland, and yet it's still all Santa Rita Hills. So he was essentially saying, as a writer, please be careful with this. So with that caveat, let me ask you, Greg, are there regions that are being more impacted by climate change around the world that you can point to more than others already?
Well, you know, I think it's a framework of understanding kind of what really is going on. Number one, all plant systems have a climate niche or a geographic range that they can grow in. Naturally. But, you know, as we manage systems like grapevines to produce a given yield and or quality or style product that we're looking for, those climate niches or those geographic ranges do change. And so we know what grapevines, Vita species, typically have a range globally for. And when we look at that, we have to think about that we're talking about numerous different grapevine varieties that are within this framework. And each one of them has their own climate niche. So if the entire species can be grown across mid-latitude regions, we might look in at one individual variety and see that it's going to be much more finite in terms of where it can be grown to produce a given wine style that is economically viable. And so when we look at that, you have to think about, okay, where is your wine region? Which varieties can it grow today and historically? And then how has climate evolved over the past 50 years, and where is it potentially going to evolve in the next 50 years? And that will determine whether or not that individual variety can perform in that environment as we move into the future. So naturally, if you're a really warm location for a variety like Pinot Noir, and you warm by a few degrees, what that does is that pushes you outside of the realm of what we know is both environmentally and economically viable today. So it depends on the variety, it depends on the region, and there are some that are more, of course, more impacted, and you could look at many of the warmest regions in the world today, southern regions in parts of Greece and Portugal and parts of Spain, even parts of Southern California and Australia have all seen temperatures going into places that we have come to see very early harvest fruit that comes in that's a little bit out of balance in terms of its chemistry And there's a lot of details that kind of go into that. But, you know, the idea is that this is happening in most places in the world, slightly different ways, at slightly different magnitudes, depending on the variety and the wine style that's being made.
Greg, when you hear comments, and I'm sure you've heard it before, when people say, well, in 50 years, you won't be able to grow grapes in Napa. I mean, you can grow grapes in Napa. I think what they're actually saying is the window for great wine quality may be shifting out for some of the warm places. But take Napa. Most of our listeners are familiar with Napa wines. Is that an over-the-top doom and gloom, or do you see some pretty high-caliber regions in trouble?
Well, you know, and I think that's the statement there is very important to understand the framework behind it. We know that both the plant system and humans, in terms of managing the plant system, adapt over time. And so when we talk about climate change in the future, we really are looking at if what we know today and historically is correct, and climates evolve, you know, to warm by 2, 3, 4 degrees, whatever the number may be, we know that that's outside the realm of what we know that those varieties can perform in and that we can manage them to perform in. So the idea there is that without some form of, or maybe a portfolio of adapted measures, we know that that's going to be a challenge for a place like Napa or really many other regions as well. So the hard part about doing any kind of both plant system and climate modeling is that it's hard to put in place what will be the adaptive measures that potentially could expand or cause that system to be a little bit more adaptable into its environment.
And Greg, whether it's Napa or Gigondas, for example, in France, I mean, there's a lot of regions that have sort of valley floors that kind of sit in the sun for a good portion of the day. And then they have, whether it's Howell Mountain or the Dente de Montmirail, which is this limestone ridge that kind of offers some shade and some protection from the sun in Gigondas for some but not all of the vineyards. Are we going to see more of a shift towards saying, okay, you can grow here, but I'm not sure a valley floor is a good idea anymore? Or are we going to be going to higher elevations, that kind of a thing?
Well, I think that's happening in many ways in many regions throughout the world. Just give you a couple of examples. In Spain, some of the regions around, if you're in Rioja or Navarre or even in Somontano and Campo de Borja and places along the Pyrenees there's a move by some of the larger corporations in Spain to start planting a little higher up in the Pyrenees, a little bit of speculation on land at different elevations that would be suitable for growing grapes. And so some of that development is already happening. In the Willamette Valley of Oregon, we have historically not planted on the valley floors, mostly because of frost potential. But the frost potential has changed overall. But also people are looking to plant a little further up the isolated mountains that we have here. Historically, it was always between 2 and maybe 600 feet in elevation in many of these viticulture areas. But now people are pushing that limit to 700, 800, where that land at the higher levels had never really been looked at before. But it's more viable today than it ever was.
Now, here's a good question already from a listener named Jared, who says, Evan, just curious to know, it feels like red wine has higher alcohol than it used to. Is that a stylistic choice, or is that because of climate change? Jared, that's a really good question. Greg, how would you answer it?
Well, you know, and I think that scientifically that's a hard question to really definitively answer. We do know that climate change has produced conditions that have altered the way in which we are seeing our ripeness characteristics come together. When we talk about ripeness, it's kind of four different clocks going on in the vine. We have, of course, fruit development that has sugar accumulation, acid metabolism, respiration, and then flavor and phenolic development. And typically, if you're in the right climate with the perfect conditions and the year is perfect, all that stuff will come together at the right time. But what we've seen is we've seen warmer climates that have produced higher sugar contents, a little bit of disconnect between some of the other characteristics. And as the grower is waiting for flavors and phenolics to come in, you end up having a product that when you ferment it, you naturally end up with higher alcohol. And so, yes, climate is clearly playing a role there. But the issue behind stylistic differences is also pretty important. And we know that some of the reviewers, the raters that look at wine historically, the Robert Parkers of the world, you know, their tastes have changed over time. The nature of a subtle, elegant wine of the 60s, 70s, and 80s out of Europe versus the big, bold wines out of Australia or California of today, it's very different. And that some of that's driven by those wine writers and a stylistic change.
Oh, Robert Parker loves Bob Evans compote syrup for a wine. You know, there's no there's no subtlety there. But Jared, that was a really good question. And if I think just to kind of maybe distilling it a little, just imagine you schedule a party and you've got the food's there, the guests are there, the drinks are there, but the music has not shown up. And you're getting sitting there going, do we wait for the music? And if you wait long enough, the food goes bad, you know, but we've got no music at the party. Well, that's the problem, is these things are not arriving at the same time, often because of climate change or these climatological differences now. And you've got to make some tough choices. So it's nice when you get everything there together. We're talking to Greg Jones, who's a research climatologist focusing on the impact of climate on the wine industry, joining us from Oregon. And in studio is Alan Laxo, Professor Emeritus in the School of Integrative Plant Sciences at Cornell University, and Suzanne Hunt, owner of Hunt Green LLC and a member of the Hunt family, which owns Hunt Country Vineyards on Cuca Lake. Let me ask, I'll start with Greg and ask all of our guests this question. When we do talk climate change in the wine industry, one of the things that you do hear locally is people saying, well, maybe this will be good for the Finger Lakes. Maybe the Finger Lakes will be a so-called winner in the winners and losers, that we will have a longer growing season. We'll have more of an opportunity to grow more robust reds because people still want us to be West Coast or something. I love our red wines in the Finger Lakes, and I'm not just a cheerleader. I'm not just saying that. But people, you know, have these ideas about what's changing and how this might be good. So, Greg, take a region like the Finger Lakes. I know it's complex, but can climate change make winners out of regions?
Well, sure it can. It can make things more suitable over the long term. It can lower risk, potentially, and risk meaning things like frost or freezes or other singular kind of weather events that can be problematic. But you have to consider really kind of the idea that average conditions can change, which could clearly make a cool climate region more sustainable, suitable over the long term. But you also have to look at that variability. How much variability from year to year, season to season, is driving some of the production and quality and style frameworks? And in some places, what we've seen worldwide is that variability is changing almost more dramatically than we would have thought. And the issue there is, of course, it's easy to manage average conditions. It's hard to manage large swings in variation.
Yeah, and so Alan Laxo is the first person who taught that lesson to me back when I had one of my first conversations on climate change in the Finger Lakes. And here I was, of course, thinking, well, maybe this is good. And Alan, I won't forget when you said, look, what happens when you go from 45 degrees to negative 5 in 24 hours? What's the risk for those vines? And that's very different than going from 5 to negative 5 or 15 to 5. So why don't you talk a little bit more about variability and what we've seen, especially in your research over the last, you know, several decades in this region?
Yeah, in the Finger Lakes especially, we have a very good weather record from the experiment station in Geneva. And looking back at that, it's quite obvious that that we have been seeing changes over the last 40 or 50 years. The changes have been really more in the winter warming. The summers have been gradually getting warmer, but the winters have been getting quite a bit warmer over the last few decades, but they've also become more erratic. And I think the listeners here would probably remember how cold it was two winters ago. And then last winter was very, very mild until Valentine's Day. And then it went to minus 12 to minus 15 degrees one night. And buds only need to be killed once. So you don't have to have prolonged periods, just one night, one hour can really do it. So things have become more erratic. We've had more droughts, 2012 and 2016. There's a lot of more variability in both the winter and summer. The warming winters in general would be a good thing for the industry because the classic wine grapes are cold tender. And some of them are pretty well adapted. Riesling, Cabernet Franc, Chardonnay can get through most of the winters fine. But some of the other ones are more tender. So having a little little warmer growing winter is good. However, there can be a flip side in between until we get very warm where there's really no winter issue. We may be in a situation where we'll get warm periods in the winter. And as you mentioned, it may warm up the vines to the point where they begin to lose their hardiness. And then the temperature goes down and we may have winter injury at warmer temperatures than you might expect if they were fully hardened as it would be in the middle of winter. Now the summers are, as I mentioned, are getting somewhat warmer. Again, more erratic, more droughts, more floods. But one of the advantages is the longer growing season, I think, is that when we have a earlier bloom, then the development of the vine is such that they begin to ripen earlier in the summer. And so if they begin to ripen earlier, you're trading some very cold weeks in October for very warm weeks in August. And so just a relatively small change there, I think, can make a big difference in ripening. So there, it's kind of a complex of things going on, some positive and some negative, as you might expect.
And Suzanne, for you and your family at Hunt Country Vineyards, do you view exactly what Alan just described as generally more positive but more of a pain? Or, you know, that variability makes it hard to plan a business. You don't know how big your production is going to be because you could have winter kill even in mild winters.
Yeah, I mean, for us, this is, you know, climate change is incredibly worrying, and it just dramatically increases the risk of, you know, farming's always been risky, it's always been difficult, and climate change just magnifies that. And I hear that from a lot of other growers in the region. This erratic weather, it increases costs, and it makes it much harder to predict and to plan. So in grapes, you know, it's important to remember that grapes are not like grains or vegetables. You can't change them every year. You know, it's 5 years before you have a full crop, and it's enormously expensive to rip out vineyards and put in new varieties and to plant new vineyards. So once we make a decision on a variety and a location, you can't change your mind. In our case, you know, we're seven generations on the same piece of land, so we have to figure out how to adapt where we are. We can't move like a lot of the literature talks about. Yeah. And I would just stress that, you know, just to give some examples, you know, with the extreme drought that we had last year, normally we wouldn't irrigate grapes, but we had just planted thousands of new replacement vines, babies that didn't have the deeper root system, so we had to go hand water thousands of vines, and that's, you know, a lot of expense and labor that we wouldn't normally have had. During the polar vortex winters, after that first winter, that it was, you know, Keuka Lake is a higher elevation than the other lakes. So we got, I think, a little more extreme cold where we were. It was minus 18 at our house. And, you know, that destroyed, I mean, that was absolutely just tragic.
That might not just kill buds, that could kill
vines.
That
can kill the vines. So yeah. We had almost no harvest that year from our Riesling, our Cab Franc, from our vinifera. And it also highlights how rugged and resilient a lot of the other varieties are, because our Vignoles could hack it, our Saval could hack it. So I think there's a lot to be said for really celebrating diversity and a broader range of grapes. But we've started taking canes of the vinifera and burying them under hay. We tried soil, we tried hay, to try and blanket them from the cold. And that's a lot more labor, a lot more expense.
Sure. I mean, you hear something called hilling up, but it's not just that. I mean, we've had winters where you don't have a blanket of snow. A snowfall blanket is actually good for the vines at that ground level when you get this cold. And we've gone without that. We had a February this year where we had half the month of February had days that were near 50 degrees. Just really, really remarkable. We're going to lose Greg Jones in a moment. So, Greg, why don't I just, you know, I wish we'd go all day, but I know you want to jump in. Go ahead, Greg.
Well, I just had a comment because, you know, I live on the West Coast, of course, and I pay attention to the whole country. And when I watch this, what a lot of people, I think the listeners would really be interested in is that when the East is warm, the typical framework is the West is cold. And so the nature of the dynamics of our atmosphere kind of produce that. So you're talking about a February that was extremely warm this year. We had places in Washington and Oregon and Idaho that were as much as 15 degrees below average and extremely cold conditions. Places in Idaho probably lost anywhere from 60 to 80% of their crop. We got down so cold. And we're right now looking at a vintage, a spring, starting off this vintage, that will be 1 month behind just last year.
Wow. So Greg, you know, to wrap up your time here, I don't want to overgeneralize, but look ahead with me now with climate change, knowing that there's a lot of effort to mitigate, but we're not going to stop it in its tracks right now. It's going to continue to impact agricultural industries like the viticultural industry. You know, what's the broad view on how we need to look at wine growing around the world because of climate change?
Well, you know, I think the mitigation piece you just mentioned is very important. Agriculture is also part of the puzzle that we have in terms of human influence on climate change. So as agriculturists, everybody needs to be a better steward of the landscapes and how they are potentially part of that. And I think wine grape production, just this industry in general, has a tendency to be more sustainability oriented and more focused on doing that. So I think mitigation is clearly a part of it. The adaptive potential is there. I think we have both genetic potential, plant breeding potential that we just need to look at and figure out how do we best address this to produce the plant systems that we need to be able to work in a new climate. But you just don't stop there. You have to think about vineyard management characteristics, whether it be how you develop vineyards to be more resilient to a given landscape, or maybe use a different part of a landscape as you develop a vineyard. Also training systems and how they're being used could be a part of the adaptive process. And then, of course, once the fruit does get into the winery, there's adaptive things that can be done there, whether it be using yeast during fermentation that have a tendency to convert sugar to alcohol at a different rate, or maybe other applications that can be done to manage fruit that may be slightly different than what we're managing today. So, I view this as a very kind of engaged, sustainable industry that has a lot of adaptive potential. We just need to, as both in research and in academia, kind of produce the technologies and the innovation that allows the industry to be able to make these kind of adaptations.
But Greg, a lot of that adaptation and innovation is not without cost. Should we expect the price of wine to go up in the future because of this, as a result of climate change?
Well, in the long term, yes. It almost has to, because you can't do much of this without having added cost involved. However, I think that, you know, it's kind of all relative compared to how other things will potentially go up with basic food sources that we have to have as well.
Thanks for taking the time, Greg. Learned so much from you and really appreciate it today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate talking in and with everybody. And Alan, good to hear from you.
Okay, nice to hear from you. Take care.
Dr. Greg Jones is a research climatologist focusing on the impact of climate on the wine industry, one of the leading voices in this field around the world, joining us from Southern Oregon University. Let's get our only break of the hour and come back and continue the conversation. We'll let you know how you can come out to an event on this subject and more and taste some wines as well. That's on Monday night. And we'll also talk about this big, thick book Suzanne Hunt brought, a history of which, you know, you think you know about a lot about wine, and then you pick up this book and you say, wow, I have so much to learn. It's this beautiful historical artifact, and we're going to talk more about that and more when we come back. Coming up in our second hour, a little poetry. It's National Poetry Month, and we're taking a look at the form. Are we teaching poetry enough when it comes to high school, middle school, the college level? Are we appreciating poetry the way it should be appreciated? Can you read a poem and not only appreciate it and enjoy it, but also appreciate the choices, the structure, the artistic nature of it? All of that and more next hour. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we have a lot to discuss in the next 22 minutes or so. Time is flying by as we talk about the impact of climate change on the wine industry here in the Finger Lakes and around the world. And our guests in studio, Alan Laxo, Professor Emeritus in the School of Integrative Plant Sciences at Cornell University, and Suzanne Hunt is here from Hunt Country Vineyards, which is hosting an event on Monday night. When I found out about this event, I asked her if she could make time for us on this Friday because I thought the subject was so interesting. The subject is what green wines are. You kind of hear about that. And they've got a collection of green wines from around the world that you can taste if you go out to the event on Monday night. They're also going to be giving a presentation on the impact of climate on the wine industry. It's happening at Hunt Country Vineyards through Women for Wine Sense, but it's for everybody. The women are cool like that. You go to womenforwinesense.org/events, piece of cake. You can find it there, or Hunt Country Vineyards online for that. So Thanks, by the way, Suzanne, for pulling this together at the last second for us. I just found Greg was so interesting, but there's a lot we did not cover. And so I'm just going to kind of keep ticking off a list of things I think are important. And I'm going to start with this. You and I emailed a lot over the last couple of days about this, and one of the things that kind of keep coming up was this. There is still skepticism. I know it is dampening, but there's still some skepticism about climate change in general. And one of the things you like to say is, well, the grapes don't lie. You know, is this a chance for you to turn around and say, how do you deny this? Is this the evidence that will actually convince people?
Yeah. No, I mean, politicians and commentators and you know, folks who have a vested interest in confusing the public about climate change versus the, you know, nearly universal consensus in the scientific community about the dynamics and the atmosphere and how they're changing. We're just like, grape growers, winemakers, they have to deal with what's actually happening. Like, they don't have the ability or the, you know, to deal with spin. I mean, the bloom dates on the grapes, based on the data that our colleagues at Cornell have been taking for many, many decades, is changing. You know, the bud break dates are changing over time as a result of the changing climate. So, you know, folks can spin and deny all they want, but the grapes don't lie.
Yeah, and I go back to 2012. You had a bud break that was something like 3 weeks earlier than normal. And I'm sitting there going, well, this is great. You know, look at you get three more weeks of growing season. And all the growers I knew were going, if we get one frost, it's not great. It can wipe out our year. Now, they didn't. They had an amazing growing season in 2012. But do you want to roll the dice like that every year or every other year or every 3 years? Because the amount of winter kill or frost damage or bud kill, you can lose half production. It's really remarkable, the variability. I mean, this is agriculture. These growers have so much variability. So, Alan Laxo, I know at Cornell, you've been helping zero in on what to grow where. How much do you see it changing in this region on what people should be growing where, and are we moving in toward more traditional warmer climate, or are you looking at other things for what we can grow?
Well, I think Greg outlined a lot of the things that can be done. In some ways, especially for wine grapes, the Finger Lakes have become noted in New York in general for Riesling. And it's a signature wine, and it wins a lot of awards. And so that's one where you have to be a little bit concerned that if it begins to get too warm, are you not going to be able to produce that quality of Riesling? Similar question for Burgundy and Pinot Noir. If they can't grow Pinot Noir, Burgundy is going to be in a lot of trouble.
So yes.
So one of the questions that can what can we do is. Are these signature varieties really adaptable? Some of the things that we can do, we can change varieties, but of course there's marketing issues and things to go with that. But we can also change the way we grow the grapes in many ways. A lot of the things that the climate of the cluster, the berries themselves, is greatly influenced by the grower, as well as the general climate. Because the growers can remove leaves and put the fruit out in the sun, and fruit sitting in the sun can get up to 110, 115 degrees in some cases, even though the temperature, air temperature, might only be 90 or so. So if you put more leaves over the fruit, it can keep the fruit cooler. So that affects the actual climate of the fruit that the fruit's responding to. And as Greg mentioned, we could go to higher elevations. Typically, our better sites are at somewhat lower elevations, plus the lake effects. And then we can also possibly in the future change the orientation of the vineyards. Start planting on north-facing.
Easy north for you to say, buddy.
That was in a very long term.
Yes.
But as we replant vineyards, we may be able to plant Riesling, say, on north-facing slopes. That would be cooler, you know, right next to the ski resorts. So there are some, we have hills, we have elevation and different orientations of the slope. So there are some opportunities there to make adaptations.
But think about the variation here. The climate change is bringing not just higher temperatures, but bigger swings. Well, imagine it's the middle of June or the end of June, you're getting into July, and it's been cold. And you go, well, I'm going to pull a bunch of leaves here. And then all of a sudden, you get 3 weeks of 97 degrees every day. and then you go, I got no protection. You can't put the leaves back on once you've pulled them. I mean, that variation is happening, and it is such a challenge for growers. It's just another reason I have such respect for the industry. And
thank God we have wine to drink.
It's really amazing. Before we get to things like mitigation, there's other things that we haven't even touched on. We haven't talked about disease pressure, the physiological changes, the fact that if you don't have cooler nights or if the nights are warmer, you get a different development in the actual grapes themselves. So, and we can even talk about oceans and sea level rise and what that means for coastal regions. I mean, there's so much at play here. Where do you go next with this, Suzanne?
Well, I think, you know, having conversations like this is really helpful because, you know, the first step is recognizing that you have a problem, and then, you know, bringing in a lot more minds into figuring out ways to both address the problem and then adapt to the changes is essential. So the more smart people we have thinking about this and working on it, the better. You know, for me, you know, some of the things we're doing at our winery and some of the things we've been working with other wineries on are things like, you know, recognizing that every sector, including agriculture, contributes to the problem. So we've installed large solar power systems. We've installed geothermal for heating and cooling. We're working on enhancing the soil carbon levels. One of the things that we should do a whole show on is soil carbon. You know, the major levers worldwide for solving climate change are reducing the switching off of swash, you know, transitioning away from fossil fuels, stop putting more carbon into the atmosphere, and then put that carbon back where it's supposed to be in our plants and in the soil. And that is also, so that's a mitigation and adaptation strategy, because once you have higher soil carbon, or another way of saying it is soil is more plant matter in your soil, then, you know, that soil, the more carbon you have in your soil, the more your soil acts like a sponge. It's a healthy, vibrant matrix. And when you have these downpours, like we had the flooding in 2014, flooding in 2015, we didn't have runoff from any of our high carbon soil on our farm because it acted like a sponge. And then in the drought last year, that high carbon soil holds a lot more moisture. So you could look out and see the rows we had mulched, and you could see that they were green, and then the row that we hadn't mulched was brown. So, you know, huge ability to help enhance our ability to deal with these weather swings by adding carbon back to our soils.
What has disease pressure been like, and have you seen more disease pressure as climate change has unfolded?
I think that's going to be a region by region thing. You know, I know the glassy wing sharpshooter is a big problem in parts of California. Here, you know, just as it, you know, I'm not the grape grower. I should have my dad and my brother here. You know, I'm seeing things, Japanese beetle damage. I don't remember that as a kid. We have stink bugs getting into the grape vineyards that, you know, I don't want them getting into the bins when we pick them.
Oh, sure.
You know, things like that, you know, just anecdotally, don't remember as a kid. There's definitely new disease pressures, new pest pressures. The disease pressure that's always been a problem is mildew. You know, that's always a problem, always been a problem in cool climate viticulture. And with these, you know, this unpredictability, you don't know how much to spray, when to spray, how many leaves, like as you said, how many leaves to remove. So, it's a moving target.
And when it comes to a disruption that's happening, sea level rise, that kind of thing, should we expect that is going to impact wine industries, do you think?
I mean, that's certainly what the literature says. You know, I was just in New Zealand visiting with growers, and they're doing all kinds of different things. I mean, they're an island nation, so they're very worried about sea level rise. I know some of the low-lying vineyards are worried about saltwater encroachment into their aquifers. You know, some of the vineyards that I visited there are putting up hail netting to try and protect the young, especially the nurseries, in case they get hail that would take out their vines. They are building water catchment ponds. You know, a lot of places in California and in other warm areas are starting to store water. There's all kinds of things that they're concerned about.
Well, I want to ask both of our guests to talk a little bit about whether they'd like to see the wine-consuming public open their minds a little. The critics want everybody to think it's vinifera or bust, and Suzanne just had a visceral reaction to that statement. And I know they both have a lot to say about this, but I don't want to get overly technical. When I say vinifera, I just mean the grapes that most listeners have heard of that are, it's sort of the main wine grapes that end up on wine lists. Cabernet Sauvignon, Riesling, Chardonnay, Merlot, those kinds of things. And then there's what we call hybrids, which is almost a pejorative in the wine world these days. It shouldn't be, because as Suzanne says, everything's a hybrid anyway. And then there's natives, which are the Concords and the what else, Al? Niagara? What else? Yep.
Well, those are the two major
Niagara and ones. Concord, yeah. Yep. Okay.
For juice.
But you have a lot of options here. You know, you think about Europe. You think about places in Europe where if climate change hits Burgundy, as Alan said, and all of a sudden Pinot is sort of cooked there, well, laws limit what they're allowed to do there. Doesn't mean that they're not secretly blending some Syrah in there. You know, that's its own story. But the law limits what you can do in certain places in certain regions. Here, it's much more of a blank canvas that you can, as Suzanne will say, it's expensive to rip out vines and plant new ones, but you can do it. And you've got an opportunity to figure out what works best here. So, Alan, I'll start with you, and then Suzanne's kind of loaded for bear on this question. You know, are we too discriminatory against, you know, non-vinifera, and do we need to open our minds, especially in this region, Alan?
Well, I can't really speak for any individual as to their opinions of vinifera versus hybrids, but there are a tremendous number of wonderful variety aromas in the hybrid grapes. We have a breeding program at Cornell that's been going on for the last 130 years, I believe. He's produced some beautiful wines and new varieties, hybrids that are more resistant to the winter colds, and they really provide a wide range of different flavor profiles. And an interesting thing I found is I have a son who's in their 30s. He and his colleagues really enjoy wine, and they're much more open to new variety, flavors. They try different types of beverages, and they enjoy wines for whatever it happens to be. They're not as tied to the label and the name. So I think it's something that is worthwhile doing, trying new things and expanding their horizon.
Alan just touched on something that's vital in the marketing world, turning something that's uncool into something that's cool. And for your 30-something son, it's become cool. It's fine. You're going to drink Vignole. Cool. It's a chance to learn something new. It's a chance to experience something new. And by the way, the quality is really good. Just because, you know, the hip kids have put it down for a long time, maybe it becomes a secret handshake wine. Maybe Valvin Muscat is going to have its day, Suzanne Hunt.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at natural ecosystems, you don't see monocultures for the most part. You know, there is resiliency and diversity. And that goes for natural ecosystems as well as agroecosystems. And so to the extent that, you know, who knows if it's growers responding to the market or the market responding to the growers and to the, as you pointed out, Evan, the wine judges and opinion leaders, we really need to change the whole conversation and really celebrate the diversity and varieties. You know, I brought this book just as a really dramatic
visual. It's called The Grapes of New York, and it's this green, bound, more than 100 years old, this book?
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. It looks like it's falling apart. And it's got a list of grapes and varieties, the likes of which I have never heard before. And it's all, your family used to do all kinds of stuff with this, didn't you?
So I've been digging into these history books. It turns out my great, 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 great uncle Josiah Prentice planted some of the first grapes commercially. I think he got some cuttings from some of the preachers in the area, and he planted the first commercial plantings around Keuka Lake, which was called Crooked Lake back then.
Like the 1840s or
1830s.
1830s.
And then in the 1850s, he sent the first shipment down to New York City. And the history books say that people went mad after the grape. And so that started the first grape boom in the region. So, you know, there were something like 22,000 acres of grapes just around Keuka Lake, 100 years ago. And just to give people an idea of scale, there's about 30 or 33,000 acres in New York State in total today. So that was a enormous boom back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that was, of course, really killed by Prohibition.
And I don't think a whole lot of it was Cabernet Sauvignon.
I don't think so. No, and you know, that's one of the things. You know, some of these varieties, like you said, I'm not sure what year Vignoles was bred, but Sauval, Vidal, some of these, you know, Vidal, we make our ice wine out of Vidal. It has those tough skins and it hangs well long, long after the regular harvest. And those grapes came from France, you know, over 100 years ago. So people, I think they hear hybrid and they think it's something new and
the French
techie.
Don't admit that.
You know, hey, there is no immaculate conception in grape variety development.
Right.
You know, everything.
You need parents.
You need parents. So, you know, even Cab Sauv came from Cab Franc.
So maybe part of our future is, you know, mitigating climate change as best we can and hoping to slow it down worldwide. But in the wine industry, opening consumers' minds beyond just what the mainstream critics would have you do. Yeah?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, and, you know, and as Alan's son has discovered, it's fun if you don't have a preconceived notion of what you should be drinking and what, you know, should be good.
And there's too much of that in wine anyway, isn't there? That's a whole other topic.
I don't want to upset people, but absolutely. You know, it's so much more interesting to go out and explore and try new things. And, you know, when we celebrate local food and we like, you know, you want to go to a given region to try their local cuisine. Why not go to a given region to try the local grape varieties?
I've got a question from a listener, but before I get to it, I just want to say this is not Suzanne or Alan or anybody saying, well, the Finger Lakes isn't going to be able to make world-class vinifera. That is not what's being said. It's being said to say, what is a toolkit that has a lot of different tools, especially in years where you may get winter kill more because of the variation in winters, because of the variation in climate that we have with climate change, that if you lose a lot of vinifera, what do you have? And are the non-vinifera options good? They could be great as long as we don't discriminate and as long as that's a tool still in our toolkit. I think that's the message I'm hearing. Is that fair, guys? Yes?
Yeah.
Because you better still make Riesling. So Joel writes to the program and says, thank you to Hunt Country Vineyards for labeling which of your wines are vegan and which are not. I wish all vineyards did the same. And so, you know, why don't we talk a little bit about what green wines are? We only got a few minutes left, but that's a big part of the program on Monday night. Mm-hmm. I know you've got wines to share from around the world. And when you see green wines on a label, sometimes it's marketing pablum, but sometimes it actually means something.
Yeah. Yeah, so it gets really tricky because there are some things like green and natural that have absolutely no definition to them. So anyone can say them and they can be greenwashing or not. Then you get into a lot of the old, you know, a lot of wineries in Europe that have been organic for a very, very long time, but they've never bothered to get certified. And so I mean, the bottom line is you have to really, you know, if you're really interested, it's worth getting to know your wineries and your winemakers and really getting to know their practices. In terms of labeling systems that make it easier for folks, especially if you're not near those wine regions and you don't have the time, there are labeling systems like USDA in this country's organic label. There are various sustainability labels and then also biodynamic labels. So and some are more rigorous than others. There are some that require a third party to validate wineries' claims and some that are self-validated. So, you know, you have to really kind of look at them and ask directly, if you can, and really be skeptical.
I mean, think about the fact that the word reserve by law in our region doesn't mean anything. There's a winery in the Finger Lakes where every wine is reserve. That's nice. That's a lot of a good red. So you have to ask at your winery, what does this mean? And if the answer is essentially nothing, that will tell you a lot. In the same way that if somebody says, well, our wines are green, but let me ask you then, what does the word green really mean? What are we looking for in green practices in winemaking, Suzanne?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of these certifications and conversations focus on the vineyards. They focus on whether or not you're using integrated pest management, whether or not you're using organic approved sprays or not, whether you're using weed sprays with glyphosate, which is now listed as a probable carcinogen. So a lot of the focus up in, you know, for a long time was just the practices in the vineyard. But as you know, everybody is, you know, as we all know, there's also, you know, a lot of energy use in the chilling and in the pumps and in the cash registers. And so then there's also, are you looking at all of the other aspects of the production of wine. And then, you know, from a classical sustainability perspective, and in my work with companies like airlines and massive international companies, when they look at sustainability across their industries, they're looking not only at the environmental impact, but also just as much they're looking at social impacts and economic impacts. So, you know, if I'm truly, you know, and what we try to do at our wineries, you know, we engage with local community. We volunteer, you know, we have everyone's a volunteer fireman, my dad, my brother, Matt. You know, we support the arts. We, you know, raise money for the animal shelter. We, you know, we do all of those social engagement pieces as well as the environment piece, as well as the business piece. And then, you know, as much as we can, the advocacy.
So when a consumer asks at Hunt, you get an answer like that. So you got to ask directly. And you're going to have a chance to taste some wines from around the world that are green wines on Monday night in the Women for Wine Sense event. Just go to womenforwinesense.org. Check out the events. It's for guys, too, which is nice. It's Hunt Country Vineyards on Monday night. Starts when, by the way, on Monday night?
6:30
at Hunt Country Vineyards. $50 if you're not a member. $40 if you're a member. They're going to have food, an organic farm-to-table menu by Chef Brad Holland, and a lot of fun there. So
do have to pre-register.
Pre-register.
By Sunday, you know, end of day Sunday.
Okay. And if not, she mentioned, you know, airline industries. You saw what happened at United. You don't want to show up on Monday night at Hunt.
I promise you will not be dragged out.
Mostly not. Thank you, Suzanne. Great seeing you.
Good to see you.
Our thanks to Professor Alan Laxo. Great to have you here, Alan. Thank you so much. More
Thank
connections
you.
Next.